the National Archives podcast series. Trenches to Triples. Linked data markup to archive descriptions relating to the First World War. Presented by Leanne Smith.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Leanne Smith, and I'm here to talk to you this afternoon about our Trenches to Triples project. I'm the Archive Services Manager for the User Services side of our Archive Service at King's College London. And for those of you who don't know, as well as the institutional archives, we're also home to the Little Heart Centre for Military Archives, which is a leading repository for research into modern defence policy in Britain. We hold the papers of around about 700, more than 700 now, senior service personnel, and we cover any conflict in which the British Armed Forces have had a presence during the 20th century and late 19th century. The archives, we've generally had a bit of a tradition of trying to be innovative around our archives holdings. We were one of the first archive repositories to produce our catalogues online, and in more recent years we've developed an iPhone app, and we've undertaken projects to look at using theatre to reimagine archives. And more recently we've been involved in a few projects looking at the use of linked data and the development of the semantic web in relation to the archive sector. As part of this, I led a JISC-funded project over last year, Trenches to Triples, which I'm here to talk to you about this afternoon. And before I go on, I think it's probably very sensible for me to be clear about where I'm coming from. I'm an archivist, I'm not a technical specialist at all, and as such, I manage user services, and I'm very interested in the ways that our resources can be more open, more visible to users, how we can attract more potential users, and how different types of users, how their experiences and their expertise and so on, influence their approaches in searching for archive material. Like I said, I'm not a complete Luddite, but I don't have any technical expertise at all, and I've got to confess that 18 months ago, I hadn't even heard of linked data, so I'm coming at this very much as a sort of beginner. Yes. Probably wise for everyone to be aware of that before I start. So before I go on to talk about the project, I'll spend a little bit of time setting it into context and explaining the rationale behind why we came up with it in the first place, really. So there are two areas which influenced our project. And the first is the upcoming commemoration of the centenary of the start of the First World War. Now, obviously, everyone's quite aware there's quite a lot going on around this in preparation. There are initiatives such as the 1914.org, led by the Imperial War Museums, and including over 850 institutions worldwide. There's also Europeana 1914-1918, which is encouraging institutions and individual users to upload digital content and to tell the stories around those relating to the First World War. And there was also the JISC World War I Discovery Programme. Now, that's in its second stage at the moment, which MIMAS is working on in developing an aggregation API to improve the discoverability of World War I content. But the first stage, King's was involved with in developing an online database of World War I resources from archives, museums and libraries all over the UK. And this also included a piece of research which examined the needs of users and of teaching and researchers around First World War resources, and aim to develop an understanding of the requirements that researchers have. And the thinking behind it really is that by understanding which content is currently being used and how it's being used, what the obstacles are for further exploitation and further integration in research and teaching, the sector will be better positioned to address them and to produce digital resources and discovery tools which are fit for purpose for researchers. And there were a couple of things that came out of this research that resonated with us when we were thinking about starting this project. First of all, issues around discovery. These were identified by those surveyed sort of identified these as a challenge for identifying material relating to the First World War. And a quote from the report, which summarises this, "The problem of locating resources and searching across information silos, even within single institutions, ranked highly as an impeding factor for academic exploitation of resources. Other difficulties included navigating through the sheer scale and weight of content available when clearly branded signposts were not always available, and it appeared that issues of discovery became most acute when the content didn't appear intuitively as part of a Google search. Other issues were those around accuracy and the provenance of information. A key issue for teachers and researchers within higher education and schools is the ability to locate and recognise trusted sources of information among the sheer mass of material available on the First World War, and the implication of accuracy and historical veracity on trusted sites. And lastly, the last point that sort of resonated with our project in particular was that there was a lack of clear vocabulary around World War One, and a clear ontological framework needed to be agreed and accepted universally using previous precedents such as subject thesaurus where possible. So the second aspect of our sort of rationale really was to build upon the work that was being done previously and was also being concurrently by some of my colleagues in King's and partner organisations on linked data in the projects Open Metadata Pathway and Step Change. Now, the premise of these projects really sort of grew from the premise that archivists don't have the technical know-how, they don't have the time to integrate linked data markup into their catalogues. Archives in general, we all know, have other issues to deal with. We have stretched resources, we don't have enough time or money or manpower to manage everything probably as well as we'd like. We have cataloguing backlogs, we want to improve the quality of our legacy catalogues, we're getting greater demand for digitised content. So all of these are sort of problems that we all have to deal with. And combining this with a lack of understanding of linked data across the sector, or at best the perception of it as a kind of nice-to-have extra, means that adoption doesn't look likely. And for us to improve this situation, for adoption to become likely, we need to develop tools that are easy to use, and they're easy to integrate the process of marking up our catalogues with linked data into the archivist's existing workflow, so they don't have to do anything vastly different from what they're already doing, which is already pushed, to be fair. So these projects and this sort of thinking led to the development of a tool called ALICAT, which stands for Archival Linked Data Cataloguing. And this is to embed linked data markup into catalogues. In essence, it's in very simplistic terms, it's basically an indexing tool which allows archivists to apply linked data markup to their catalogues without them really knowing it. Also out of these projects was the release of AIM25 UCAT as a linked data service, which gives archivists the access to linked data through there. And there was also work with Axial to integrate the technology behind ALICAT into Calm version 9.3, and that's being developed for the next release of Calm version 10. So we're building on all of that work when we started this project, Trenches to Triples. And what we aimed to do was to take our World War One related catalogues from the Little Heart Centre for Military Archives as our sample, and to create linked data entities via ALICAT. And whereas the tool was initially designed just to work with collection level descriptions, we wanted to try and apply it to item level as well. And we wanted to demonstrate the feasibility of connecting this service to a cataloguing system that wasn't Calm. We also wanted to create an API to share the data that we created. And we wanted to look at the way in which this would be visualised in the catalogue front end as well. And underpinning all this, we had to also come up with a World War One specific vocabulary of personal place, corporate subject terms, for integration into UCAT, a far more granular set of data than previously existed. And generally, overall, we simply wanted to act as a kind of case study, really, to test the feasibility of this, and to be able to provide something that could be used by other archives as guidance who are potentially thinking about going down this route as well. So what I'm going to do next is just to show you some of the key aspects of Alleycat really and give you a flavour of how it works. I'm very scared of live demonstrations because the internet likes to fall over when I try to do things like that. So what I've done instead is just gone for the screenshot option. I think it's much safer. So here we go. First of all, actually before you get to here, you log in. I didn't think to put a shot of the login screen, but yes, you log in with a password protected sort of login portal, which, you know, is understandable. And once you've done that, you reach something like this, which basically shows all of our different catalogues. There's an alphabetical list across the top, so you can navigate fairly easily to find the catalogue that you want. So these are ours from King's. So once you've selected the collection, you get into the collection level description. You've got the various ICG sort of aspects across the top, and then the fields sort of listed below. What you can't see on this screenshot is if you get right to the bottom of the screen. And down the bottom, you have another one, the tabs like this at the top. There's another one at the bottom called Details, and that is where you go if you want to drill down into the item level descriptions. So you get a sort of hierarchical tree at the bottom you can open and draw your way down into the item level descriptions in your catalogue. So what you do next is at the top there, at the moment there's only a couple of data sources that we're using. So you select which one you want to use to process your data against. You then click into the section which you want to process, which scope and content is generally the one you want to do. So click in there, click somewhere else on the screen, and Alleycat starts to do its work, it starts to process. So yeah, it sort of has a little think for a moment, and then it will give you something like this next. So when it's done its processing, it brings up the terms which it's found in the description field in which it's looking. And the fields are colour-coded, so you've got blue for personal names, you have got green for places, you have red for concepts and subjects, and you've got a kind of brown colour for organisational terms. So if the terms are highlighted, you can just click on them. Alleycat will ask you, is this what you mean? And you agree with it if that is what you mean. But it is a computer, and it does rely on human interaction, and sometimes it doesn't get it right. And sometimes, as you can probably see there, it doesn't pick up all the terms that you want it to. And if that's the case, you can interject yourself, really. So the next thing that you can do is you can tell it to assign meaning to terms that it hasn't already picked up on. So in this instance, I've highlighted the term Fortisars here because it didn't pick it up in its processing. And it asks you, what is it? Is it a concept, a place, a person, an organisation? So you tell it it's an organisation, and then it gives you some options. Now, in this case, I did want to tag the Queen's Royal Hussars, which is an alternative term for that. So it came up at the bottom, you select it, and then it gets added into the list at the right-hand side, which is all of your index terms. So there you go, you can see it at the bottom there. If it doesn't know, you can add things in manually as well. So if it doesn't come up with any options from searching from the things, you can add the detail in manually. And the idea is that it can actually, it's a two-way system, it can actually update AIM25 UCAT at the same time. So it draws information in and you can sort of push it back out again. There's a whole other presentation around this and the way we've got to think about this a little bit more. Think about the sort of permissions around this and the authentication, and think about making sure that we can ensure that the integrity of the data is there, that sensible data is being pushed back in. It's a big issue which I don't have time to talk about now, so I'm not going to, but it's something that should be raised and is something that does need to be thought about going forward. The other thing you can do is with places, and places is a little bit sort of easier really, because it uses Google Maps, which is nice and helpful. So in this example, I wanted to mark up Scupa Flow and assign that as a place. So you highlight it, you click on it, it asks you, what is this? Is it a concept, place, person, organisation? And you tell it it's a place. And what you get next is a pop-up with a Google map in the middle. Obviously, I was in London when I was doing it, so it starts on London. And at this point, you've got a choice. Sometimes you will find that AIM25 UCAT knows where you're talking about, and in this instance it does, so you can see it very faintly in green at the bottom there. It says Scupa Flow in the Orkney Islands in Scotland. If it doesn't know, you can use the map to find your place, and in fact in this example I just used the map because, well, I'm trying to demonstrate using the map really. So it's the same as any Google map, so you can either type the place in the top and it will find it for you, or you can just drag the map around until you find it, which, if you know where it is fairly problem-free. If you don't, it's probably not so much. And once you've found it, you can just tag the location. And then it gets added to the list of access points at the bottom. So the other thing I need to mention are the exclamation marks all down the side, which I'm sure you've all noticed. They look a bit fierce. they were actually introduced as part of the pilot testing process, and they do have a role. They're not just scary warning signs. When we first started using AliCat, because our catalogue's already indexed, all of the index terms are showing up at the side. And we had no way of knowing which ones we'd marked up using the tool and therefore sort of bringing the linked data element into it, and which ones were already there from way back. So these exclamation marks were introduced to alert the archivist to the fact that these terms are already your index terms, but you haven't processed them using the tool, you haven't done the linked data element. So that's quite easy to deal with. You see the exclamation marks, you just click on them and it brings up a choice of terms. In this case, because we clicked on World War I, it's brought up a lot, because obviously World War I is a term which has a couple of broader terms and it has countless narrower terms sort of nestling underneath it in the hierarchy. But World War I's the top one, so that's quite easy. You click on it, and then the exclamation marks have disappeared, so then you know that you have marked that up using the AliCat tool. So that's really, in a nutshell, AliCat. And the next thing that I want to do is just to go over some of the outcomes of the project. The first one is the creation of the World War One specific terminology, which we've now integrated into AIM25 UCAT. The process of doing this and the resulting dataset that we got at the end were both very important outcomes for the project, really. Because initially we planned to use AliCat to add the additional terms to AIM25 UCAT as we went along. But there was a delay in the beginning with technical development, and that gave us a little bit of time. And to get everything done in the timescales, we thought we'd better start doing that up front. And that actually turned out to be a blessing, and it was a good thing that we ended up doing that in the end, because that gave us an opportunity to reflect on some of the issues that we might not have considered so deeply if we'd just gone straight into processing all of our data and integrating the extra terminology as we went along. So the terminology that we created had to be useful for a diverse range of users. And as we created our new set of of authority terms, it was important to take into account the different needs of our different users, because this determined the range of granularity that we needed. So, for example, if I take First World War battles, if we're looking at our different users, we might have an undergraduate who might be asked to examine the conflict in quite a broad way, just by looking at trends and patterns across different theatres of war, whereas a genealogist might only be concerned with battles at which one particular soldier was at part, so they only want very specific battles. An academic researcher might want to look in great detail at one particular action or incident that occurred during a particular battle, but keep that in context with the context around the incident, the battle, the operation, and the theatre of war in which it was situated. So each of these scenarios demands a different degree of granularity. An undergraduate would be happy with quite general terms. The genealogist just wants a list of battle names. The academic wants to probably see the whole hierarchy of structure. And to satisfy all of this, we had to think about finding an acceptable range from the general to the specific. So we actually used the... We had one of our project team was an academic with specific World War One military history expertise, and through sort of liaison with her and her liaison with other academics, using the very snappily titled The Official Names of the Battles and Other Engagements Fought by the Military Forces of the British Empire During the Great War, 1914 to 1919, and the Third Afghan War, 1919, proved to be the best resource, really, because this tabulated all of the on-land battles and the engagements according to the descending scale of levels. So we could use this and we could decide sort of what section, really, what level of information would be useful and would get the balance right between trying to satisfy as many of our users as possible and also work with the fact that we had limited time, limited people resources, and we couldn't put the whole thing in there. So that was one of the things that really came out of that consideration beforehand. The other thing is something we're all pretty familiar with, which is different users use different terms to describe describe the same things. There's never complete consensus in any area of study regarding which definitions are official and which aren't. Terminology changes as trends come and go. And for a subject as widely studied as World War One, there's a contrast between how events and concepts are understood by different types of researchers. For example, one we come across a lot, simply because we have an awful lot in our archive about it, is the Dardanelles campaign, which is the approved term, but most people, particular amateur enthusiasts, tend to know it as Gallipoli, and we need to be able to reflect the needs of both camps by including both terms. So the fact that circumstance gave us a real opportunity to think about this before we started meant that we ended up creating a far more useful and a far more carefully considered data set than we may well have done had we just gone straight in as planned at the beginning. And it also raised the important point that when we're looking at specialist subject record sets, a significant initial investment of time in creating these vocabularies is essential if one doesn't already exist for the subject area. Excuse me. One thing that is helpful is that the system does continuously learn, so the more you put in, the more it sort of brings them back out again. So hopefully that means the investment in time in preparation should decrease the more it's used. The vocabulary itself is looking like it's been a very worthwhile sort of investment. The need for this was identified in the GISC report that I mentioned earlier. And on this is clearly a very useful resource, particularly in the lead up to the 1914 commemoration events. Various different institutions have been interested in what we've been doing, and the IWM we've been sort of talking with them about possibly them using this in their discovery program. So that would be a really good thing if that ended up happening. And the last thing is that we have demonstrated the concept. I need to rush now because I don't have very much time. So we have used Alicat to add this markup to our catalogues. We have adapted the front end to allow the visualisation of these entities. And this has worked very well in the case of places. As you can see, this is a screenshot of our one of our catalogue pages with places. When you click, you get taken to the place and you can see it, and that's worked very well. We need to do a bit more work around the people, corporate names, subject terms, to see what that will resolve to. At the moment, it just resolves to data, which for a user is probably not the most useful thing, but it gives us a base to work from, which is good at this stage, I think, given the amount of time we've had. I'm not going to worry about people so much. I know that Linking Lives has been looking at that a lot, and I don't think we need to double up on that, really. But subject and corporate entities do need more consideration. So the next steps really are working more on the front-end visualisation. And this is likely to come about as more resources are available for linked data, made more available via linked data. Also, we are talking about embedding microdata into the entities, which apply greater machine-readable meanings to the entities, which that will be where the real gains for the user do come. From my perspective, I think continuing the ongoing work from the Loblam community more generally in agreeing standards for linked data adoption will be a great way of going forward. At the moment, we have lots and lots of different projects going on, and there is work towards this. In December, there was a roundtable discussion, and lots of things to go forward have come out of that, and I think it would be very good to keep the momentum up if we want this to be adopted across the sector. We need to keep that momentum up. And the last thing, obviously, got that one, increasing understanding and training in the archive sector. A lot of us still have virtually no idea about this, and it would be good if there were more opportunities, even at a very basic level, for greater understanding and training to occur across the sector. And the one thing that is evident above everything else for me is that this approach is hugely reliant upon the understanding of the data. And the knowledge of the collections that archivists have is of huge importance in going down this route. And for it to be a successful approach long term, it will require the buy-in of us as archivists and curators, and from our users as well as the technical specialists as well. We all need to work together on this one.
This talk was recorded on the 7th of March 2013 at the National Archives, Kew. This podcast is copyrighted to the National Archives. All rights reserved.